Have you finished your personal statement yet? Now's the perfect time to get it professionally reviewed by a medical school HQ expert advisor. We have former directors of admissions, admissions officers, and the like on our small team of amazing people. They have the inside knowledge from reading thousands and thousands and thousands, tens, if not 100,000 personal statements going through the process and setting up the process for their whole committee. They know exactly what medical schools look for and the common red flags that can get your entire application thrown out. Take advantage of our flash sale right now, going through May 6th, up to 6,000 characters reviewed for just $150. That's a $75 discount on our regular price. Go to editmyps.com. Again, that's editmyps.com. The pre-med year, session number 535. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. And welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have a great guest joining me today, Dr. Paul Tran, who's going to talk about eating our young. Before we jump into that, though, I want to talk about the MCAT Minute brought to you by Blueprint MCAT. Did you know that Blueprint MCAT has an amazing free plan to help you do better on the MCAT? Go to blueprintmcat.com today. Their free account will give you access to a half-length diagnostic, a free full-length exam, a study planner tool, and an amazing flashcard platform, all to help you score higher on your MCAT. All right, today I'm talking to Dr. Paul Tran. You can find him on TikTok. He is a pediatric GI doc. His username is Elementary School, A-L-I-M-E-N-T-A-R-Y School. Elementary School. Nice little play on words there, Dr. Paul Tran. We're going to talk about eating our young in medicine. It was a discussion that he had on TikTok. He made a video about it. I'm like, oh, that's a great discussion to have on the podcast. So I brought him on to talk about it and what he's doing to change it. Paul, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Man, thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to chat. You are TikTok famous. You are a pediatric gastroenterologist having finished your fellowship. Congratulations on finally being at the end of the race. How's that feel?
It feels like everything that you wanted or I wanted and more in terms of the juggling multitudes of things, trying to keep the plate closest to the ground from falling. And honestly, though, I wake up every day really excited to do what I do. And it's cool after you go through training, which can be grueling. I mean, I did 3 years of residency, 3 years of fellowship. That's like as a pediatric subspecialist, it's almost like a surgical or more than a surgical residency, which we think of the longest. And it's like, Hey, I still love it. So
yeah,
it's been great.
Why did you get involved in medicine to begin with? What was your draw to this field?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, I love the connection and that kind of intimate space that you have with your patients. I mean, that's something that as a pediatrician, you know, you see, you know, you have vulnerable patients, you have children, and you have families. And I think that I was thinking about what other field do you have such a vulnerable connection or a connection where you're in an intimate setting or you have someone being so vulnerable and outside of religion, I couldn't think of a field, you know, outside of healthcare, not just being a physician, but like in healthcare overall, it's like, you know, that's a really tremendous responsibility. I think a lot of fulfillment to be found in it.
Yeah. Now that you're an attending, you're out of training, the tests never end. The learning never ends, obviously, unfortunately. But now that you're an attending, you look back on this path that you've been on, right? 3 years of residency, 3 years of fellowship, 3 or 4 years of med school, depending on where you go. Looking at it all, what is the most asinine part of this journey? Like the craziest part that is just the hardest to explain to people like the things that we have to do to get to this point?
I would say twofold. The culture that you embark on that you don't know, that you're getting into. And the intense amount that kind of goes with the culture. I think the intense amount of sacrifice that you are just expected to make, without real consideration of, you know, how detrimental it is to you personally or to your family life. And it's just, that's part of the job. You got to do it. I mean, certainly we can talk more about that, but I can give personal examples that are like, come on, that asinine to use the word.
Where are those expectations coming from? Are they being perpetuated just because they're out there, or are those that are at the top of the hierarchy still expecting and verbalizing and demanding?
I think it's a lot more quiet and insidious than that. It is a unspoken or sometimes spoken, I did this, so you can do it too. I got through this training. Yeah. I got through this immense back in my day.
Yeah.
Right. You can do it through, like you can do it too. Like, now, for instance, well, step one is pass fail.
Yep.
For medical students. Well, back in my day, pass, it wasn't
it
pass
wasn't.
Fail. Yep. So I had to really work to get my score. I was like, well,
yeah. Kids these days have it easy.
Exactly. It's this kind of generational thing. And I think, as a new faculty, you know, people are like, why are you so interested in helping change that medical education culture?
Yeah.
Why are you so interested in what you're doing? Because I devote a lot of my work, research wise, scholarship wise, my day to day to medical education. Why do I do it? Because I was just there.
Yeah.
I literally just went through it and I saw what sometimes is that culture that I'm trying to change. I want to try to change right away. And it's frustrating at times when you're getting into it.
When did the culture for you start to rear its head? Was it something that you understood coming in, or as a first year med student, you're out with your preceptor and you're like, oh, like this isn't what I expected. When did that start to come to light for you?
No, it's third year of medical school.
Okay.
Because I would say this is just my impression, one person's perspective, but the more patient responsibility you have, the higher the stake, obviously. And I think the more intense pressure that you should feel and you do feel.
Yeah.
You know, every step of the way, you could say, is the hardest part of the journey. The first year of medical school, you're learning the new language of medicine. And I actually did, actually on graduation, I had a really nice round number, 10 years, 4 years of med school, 3 years of residency, 3 years of fellowship. I did a TikTok video ranking what I thought were the hardest years.
Yeah.
And I think as you go on in responsibility, being an intern is tremendously difficult when you're a doctor for the first time and you're like, what I'm doing. I have a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. And then when you're a senior resident and you're like, I'm barely competent as an intern. I feel like I'm finally getting my footing as a doctor. Now I have to supervise other doctors. And I'm a subspecialist now, and I don't know how to be just a specialist. So I think going back, you know, third year of med school, when you wear the hats of different specialties and you're there and it's really exciting and you realize, wait, the clinical world is different. It's really different. And there's a lot of these expectations. And I remember being on a specialty service I won't name that was really malignant to me personally as a medical student.
Yeah.
I was in an environment where every other person in the room was singing and humming and having a good time and
Surgery. You're talking about surgery.
It was not surgery.
Oh, actually, but OB. You can, it's OB. You can
get the Plead the fifth. I literally was humming as a medical student in the room, in the room. I was humming along with everyone else and I didn't hear a word, not a word of feedback or anything. And then on my written evaluation a month later, when you hum or sing in the OR, you come off as really uninterested. That was on my written evaluation. Oh, wow. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
Yeah. So there's this culture. There's this, you can't talk to people. You can't have a meaningful, kind, empathetic conversation. I would love it if a senior resident or someone had said, hey, just a heads up. Like, you know, as a student, we have a decorum, but whatever. Even if I disagreed, I would have liked you to, or them to talk.
Just communicate. Yeah. Set the expectations so that I know whether or not I'm meeting those expectations. You have to have those expectations. So you go through this process. Why did you start to become interested in talking about it and potentially throwing your hat in the ring to start changing it?
Because who else is doing it? There was a noticeable gap I saw, at least on social media. So TikTok, I really just post on TikTok because I saw on TikTok there's a lot of students who, you know, glamorize, you know, I think just showing the light of being a first or second year, a student. And there was very little about the clinical year beyond. Third year, fourth year, and
it's because they're all crying in the corner. They don't have time to post.
Like, it's because there's not a lot of time, but there's also not a lot of help resources out there. And I think I found overwhelmingly there was negativity, and I actually want to be a source of positivity. It sounds weird because I've talked mostly about negative things, but I want to be a source of, hey, there is kindness, there's compassion, there's empathy in education, not just what we're expected to show patients, but also what we're expected to show each other as colleagues. And you know what? It's like the gray hairs that we think of as medical educators, right? You don't go out of training becoming an educator. Why? You're trying to establish yourself as a clinician. You're trying to grow your practice. Like you don't have enough knowledge or experience yet. So I think there's this traditional model where the most established people in education are at the twilight of their careers. They're on the tail end. So they're kind of, I'm not saying that they're not in touch, but sometimes they're not in touch.
They're in touch. I call them the old crusty white guys.
Yeah. When you're talking about when I did training, you did training, it was very different, even if it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. That should never be uttered with the pretense of, I'm going to tell you why your complaints are invalid. Like, if you want to talk about when you're in training just to show a difference, great. Doesn't mean it's better.
That's right.
Yeah, I was talking about it today, actually with a student, and for another interview, for another podcast episode, and the conversation was this language of, well, resident physician was because the actual physicians were living at the hospital. They were residents at the hospital. And back then, it kind of made sense. We didn't have computers and iPhones and all of this technology and information at our fingertips. We had to live and breathe medicine to understand it, to learn it, so that we could take care of patients. But now, right, do we need it? And nobody is actually taking a step back going, do we really need to do these things anymore? We just continue to perpetuate. What? Why? Right? We are supposedly the enlightened ones who are practicing evidence-based medicine, and we're constantly updating our standard of care based on new data coming out, new research, and new therapeutics. And yet we're still here cracking the whip going, hey, get to work. You have to work 26 hours, whatever it is, so that you can learn and do this. Why? Mm-hmm. Why on one hand are we saying, let's always update our standard of care, and on the other hand, we're not updating our standard of education?
it seems backwards, right? Well, exactly. And on a positive note, that's going back to your question. That's what draws me.
Yeah.
Because it's like teachers, right? Like elementary education, you know, when we go through a teacher, if I wasn't in medicine, I'd probably be a teacher because you have a profound impact on people that your students touch.
Yeah.
So if I can, as an educator, if I can influence for better, if I can inspire, if I can cultivate a culture just even locally that is moving the needle forward, I get to influence all of the patients that that student or that trainee touches in the future.
Yeah.
And I think that's that network effect is really, really fulfilling, and it's like really awe-inspiring, and honestly, that's what keeps me going.
Yeah. Do you think we would be having this conversation? Obviously, we connected through social media. So besides that, do you think we would be having this conversation if it weren't for social media to allow different pockets of students and residents to go and talk about their experiences and bring to light these potential issues, for someone else to go like, oh, I thought it was just me. I thought it was my problem. I thought it was an issue that I had, that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't strong enough, that I didn't have the mentality to handle this. But I'm seeing this person and this person and this person, all at different programs, all in different specialties, all saying the same thing, right? I don't know if this is the right analogy, but it's almost like a child coming from an abusive household not knowing that all parents aren't abusive. They just don't know because until they're older and can start asking questions. Do you think we would be having this conversation if it wasn't for social media shining a light on these things?
It's definitely facilitated a lot of, it's illuminating.
Yeah.
A lot of these dark areas and facilitating a lot more conversation about it. You feel really isolated when you're a resident and you're showing up to work bright and early. You're not seeing the sun. You're going in before the sun comes up and you're leaving when it's dark out, and rinse and repeat sometimes. Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard and isolating.
Yeah.
So I think seeing the shared experience is very powerful, and definitely social media has helped with that.
Yeah. One of the biggest issues that I have seen with this process and talking to students who have had problems with their medical education with different programs and people is the hierarchy of medical education and medicine in general. For a medical student to lodge a complaint against a resident, a fellow, an attending is blasphemy. And that person is potentially in control of that student's evaluations, which are going to go in the dean's letter. And that's going to go to your program directors when you're applying for residencies. There's this constant fear of retaliation that seems somewhat unique to medical education because there are so many steps and hoops that you have to jump through to get to that final destination. How do we create a culture when the system is set up in the way that it is right now? How do we change that?
That's a great question. Two things come to mind immediately based on conversations I've had recently or honestly every day. One of the things is, I think it's the way that you interact with other people. One of the things I've done here, at Colorado, in residency, in fellowship, I was in pediatrics is, I know, different than other specialties, but it was a first name culture.
Yeah.
My mentor, my division chief, like 60, 70, it was their first name. And I come here as an attending and I am called Dr. Tran. And I'm like, please don't call me Dr. Tran. Please don't call me Paul.
Yeah.
And people are like, well, it's a respect thing. I'm like, I don't need to be called Dr. Tran to shouldn't be shown respect. That's, yeah. I really appreciate it. But please call me Paul. And I'm very insistent. And I understand, I introduce myself to patients as Dr. Tran, but with my colleagues, with anyone that I work with, students, residents, I'm Paul. And people are like, why?
Yeah.
Because this is my two answers to that are, I was just Paul as a fellow. I was just Paul as a resident. Why, when I became an attending, am I instantly Dr. Tran and that modicum of respect is demanded or intrinsic? That doesn't make sense to me. So the fellows who were my co-fellows, are they expected to call me Dr. Tran all of a sudden when we were literally just colleagues? So it's a false construct to me of that hierarchy. And it just makes that hierarchy more, the problems with it more pronounced. So that's one thing that we can do. It's so small, and I think people would disagree, but to me, I think it's important. And the second reason I think it's important is because, exactly as you brought up, let's say you're my resident and I'm your attending. If I make a mistake, if I do something egregious, and that you are like, that's, I gotta say something. If you were like, if you don't feel comfortable going to me and saying, hey, Paul, I saw that and that didn't really sit the right way. I just wanted to kind of clear the air. It removes that little barrier. If you can just call me Paul, but if you're like, Dr. Tran, my attending, hey, that was inappropriate. Like it just seems like that, like it just, there's that little tiny bit of friction that prevents you from approaching. And that's why we get those anonymous evals instead of the just face-to-face, frank, open, honest conversation. I think just the way that we address each other, the way that we feel, we foster that environment that you think is conducive to collaboration and cooperation and teamwork. I think it's that, like, hey, please feel free to call me Paul. Like, bring up anything you want. I'm really open and honest. I hope that I can give you honest feedback, and I hope to get it in return. I think that's one. And the other thing is, this is specialty specific, but I just talked to a third year student. I was interacting with her for 1 week. She was on the pediatric service, and I'm a specialist. At my hospital, we don't have a primary GI service. We're consultant. So we just kind of round with the primary team, and I spent 1 week with her. And at the end, she just gave me feedback and said, thank you so much for taking, you know, an interest in me and like helping me, essentially. Like, and what she said was such a low bar. I was like, can you tell me a little bit more? I'm like, yeah, I love it. Like, but what did I do? Well, like, I'd love to, like, you just, like, paid attention to me on rounds. You, like, looked at me,
yeah,
and you gave me feedback on rounds that kind of encouraged me, and you, like, applauded my plan and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what do other people do? She's like, oh, I was presenting on another specialty and no one even looked at me when I was talking. Like, no one would even look up. And I'm like, that is not me as a medical educator shining and being above. That's just me looking at a person.
Yeah.
Right? A student, a resident, just looking at someone when they're talking.
Yeah.
That's a really low bar. And if we can do that,
yeah,
and make students feel valued,
yeah,
great.
So obviously we can't paint a broad brush with this student's experience with the other attendings, residents, fellows, whoever, and say, oh, they are all just horrible people and how dare they. There probably is something in this medical education training world that leads people down this path to be burnt out and to be super just checked out, pessimistic. I can't think of the right word right at this moment, but there's something about medical education that led to all of those people that she's with to not look at her, to ignore her, to be checked out. What is it?
the system is it's hard to navigate. I mean, yeah. Think about this. We go back to what I said about as you get more patient responsibility, I think the burden of that responsibility is heavier on your shoulders. And if I'm an intern and I'm just trying to struggle to take care of my 20, 40, 60 patients, and I'm trying not to kill someone, I'm trying to do what's best for my patients, I'm struggling to stay afloat, and I don't feel like I have support, and I'm sleep deprived, I don't have time to look at a medical student and say, hey, great job, like, and give you feedback. I don't have, not that I don't want to, I would love to do that. I just feel like I don't have the support in the system to do that. I'm trying to train. And then you're a senior resident, you're assigned medical student, you're trying to delegate, and you're saying, hey, this intern go with this student, this intern go with this student. I'm trying to make sure my 60 patients, my 100 patients, whatever your service is, every single patient now that the interns are covering, I need to know about, right? So you're each, as you keep going, and then, and I'll tell you, as a new attending, if I wasn't as passionate and dedicated as I am, I see how hard it is. It's really, really hard. When you're an attending and you're dealing with the cognitive load, and that imposter syndrome that everyone feels every step of the way, there was no greater imposter syndrome than my first 6 months as an attending, where I'm like, the buck stops with me. I'm my name's on everything.
Yeah.
No one's checking me. I make the decision. If I'm dealing with that cognitive load and I'm trying to do right by my patients and supervising the people who are taking care of my patients, because my name's on all of that.
Yeah.
And then there are learners who I want to foster. Yeah, if I wasn't as dedicated, it can't be a priority, because you're trying to do all the other things. So people are overburdened, I think, and stretched thin with the amount of things that we have to do. So it does take, it takes a lot of energy and a commitment to look up from your list when you're thinking about what are the next 10 patients I'm going to do, like who's got to go to the OR if you're on surgery, like who's going to go to the OR emergently, hey, this patient post-op's not doing very well, whatever. I'm prioritizing that in my mind. You know, it takes a lot to look up and look at a student and listen to them without thinking about other things and say, hey, I heard you. I think that you did a great job of that presentation. Here's something you can think about in the future.
Yeah.
It's a lot of effort.
Yeah. Medical education isn't going to change tomorrow, right? The pre-med student listening to this isn't going to all of a sudden be in the land of enchantment and have 3 days a week during residency of work, and the rest of the time they can go and relax and recuperate and work on their self-care. For someone who's thinking about entering this process, and we're sitting here going, oh my gosh, it's horrible. There's still a lot of magic in medicine. There's still an amazing, as you mentioned earlier, right? That 100%. That vulnerability, that patient care, that connection, that relationship is something that can't be taken away. What can a student today do without stepping on too many toes to start to make the process better?
I think in all of this discussion, it seems like I'm just adding and piling on to the negative, negative, negative. Mm-hmm. But there are many beautiful moments, and there is just beauty in the day-to-day too. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that is something I tell all the students and residents that I mentor now is hone your why. And what I tell pre-med too is hone your why, your true reason for going into medicine, because the why is not just a personal statement fodder. It's not just what to get you through the interview. The why is what sustains you when you're a pre-med taking the MCAT and struggling through that, to when you're an intern dealing with 10 admits and you're like, I have no idea how I'm going to get through this. That crystallized why of medicine is so important. It's so important that I actually rewrote my mission and vision statement a couple years ago as I was in fellowship thinking about what I want my career to be shaped as. I think that why, more than what we talk about, the got to flesh it out more than the I want to help people, mm-hmm. right? Like, we all want to help people. I think everyone helps people to some extent. But if you have a crystallized why early on in the process, that only helps you more later on. To me, to shed some light on that, my mission and vision statement is to equip and empower my patients to be better advocates for themselves, for their own healthcare. And I want to equip and empower learners to be a better advocate for their own education. That is my mission statement. So every day, you know, I'm on service and it's really tough. I'm seeing really sick patients. Well, at the end of the day, I want to equip and empower this patient who might be struggling with their circumstances right now, severe illness, a new diagnosis. It's really hard. I want them to be better advocates for their own healthcare. So they don't need me. It's not the work that I'm doing. They're equipped to succeed. Same thing with a learner, regardless of your circumstance, regardless of your knowledge, skills, talent at a given time, you know, thinking about the growth mindset and that those are all changeable, but how do you get equipped and empowered to succeed in your own journey? So I think thinking about a why is something, and crystallizing a why is really important. And then something that is really interesting that I've seen, and I'd love to hear your experience about this, but I've seen medical students and residents lose the actual curiosity of why. Not the mission why, but like, do this plan, start this antibiotic, why? And it's you're becoming more of an order jockey and just like, okay, put in orders. Oh, like, and it's like well, the algorithm says this, right? ChatGPT can do that instead. Like, instead of where we come in is our clinical reasoning. So developing the why. So like, I made a series of videos about this. Like, current jelly stools and intussusception is a great current jelly stools refers to this mucusy red bloody stool that you get in intussusception, this process where the intestines kind of swallow each other up. And
I got to be a first assist on an intussusception case when I was a med student. Like, the best thing in my life. I was like, this is amazing.
It's so cool. It's so cool. But no parent is going to come in and be like, my kid has current jelly stools. We're like, what the heck? But that's like a board. It's a board pearl. And you just remember current jelly. But when in the last time you actually sat down and thought, what does current jelly mean? Instead of just remembering the board pearl. Like, why do you get current jelly? Oh, it's because you get lack of blood flow. You get venous stasis, and that area gets local ischemia.
Yeah.
When you think about the why for that early on, you become less of, oh, this language of medicine is so much. I got to do Anki cards. I just got to cram this. Start early learning how to use the language of medicine.
Do you think... There has been a tremendous shift and focus on board scores over the last 20 or 30 years for competitive specialties and for most specialties these days. My assumption is, my hypothesis is that it's that drive for testing or teaching for the test that has driven a lot of that. Like, I don't need to know why current jelly happens. I just need to know that it's associated with intussusception. I need to know what the treatment plan is. I need to know what the complications are. I need to know all of this other stuff because that's how the boards are going to ask me the question. Right? We've got into these pearls. We've got into these just little vignettes of information that I need to know. And that's all that I need to know. And with step one, going pass fail, which I think is huge. It's a licensing exam, not a quantitative, like, how much do you know? Like, we've set a bar to say you can practice medicine in this country. It doesn't matter how far above that bar you go. We've set a minimum. So I think they made a huge mistake not making step two and three also pass fail. So it just increases the weight on those, especially step two. Do you think that is potentially why we have lost that curiosity, that constantly seeking the why, because we know, because first aid says so, because Pathoma says so, because Sketchy says so. I don't need to know that stuff. I'm just learning what they tell me because that's all I need to know.
Yes. And you're bringing up resources that are third party. Medical students say all the time, oh, I don't pay attention to lectures.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pay attention to lectures because like the stuff that I need to know for the boards are other resources.
Yep.
Oh, the constant complaint. And I know because I was an assistant course director for the GI block at the University of Colorado for first year med students.
Yep.
And it's really hard to, it's really, really hard to trust that this lecturer with their 80 to 90 slides actually is going to prepare me for the board rather than just the clinical stuff. But then now in hindsight, I'm like, some of that clinical stuff was gold. I just didn't appreciate it then. I didn't have the capacity to. You can't, because you're literally learning how to speak the language of medicine, and you're really drinking from the fire hose. So at some point, that's why I've tried to say, like, yeah, to learn a new language, you're going to have to do flashcards to just get the vocab. But at some point, you have to go out there and practice the language. You have to, it's not enough to just use flashcards. You have to practice speaking it. You have to practice using it. And that's the immersion of learning a new language. And that's kind of what the traditional route of third year clerkship is. But if we can start introducing more like use early on in medical school, first and second years, then I think that you introduce the why, and I think that sticks a little bit more.
Yeah.
As you're learning the sheer volume. And, you know, I think I say this to anyone who's listening, when you're starting as a pre-med, that mentality of you're defined by your numbers, you're steeped in it.
Yeah.
From so early on, pre-med weeder classes, how did you do in biochem? Oh, A minus or lower? You're not good enough. You're defined by your MCAT. You're defined by your GPA. You're defined by your science GPA. You're defined before by your step one score, your step two score, your step three score. You're defined by the number of honors that you have. We say this in medicine all the time, or at least I heard it. I said it as a supervisor, and I heard it all the time. The patient is more than their number.
Yeah.
That GI bleeder is more than their hemoglobin of 7.
Yeah. We don't treat the number. We treat the patient.
We don't treat the number, we treat the patient. So why are we seeing ourselves in medicine and before and going in the process as a number?
Yeah.
Like it just is backwards against it. It's like what you were saying. Education lags behind the clinical world.
Yeah.
So that's the mentality I think we need to beat out.
Yeah.
You're so much more than a number and your grades. So yeah.
Has a patient ever asked you about your MCAT score?
Yeah, every day. Yeah,
of course.
They're like, so you're 8 months. I see you're new here.
Yeah.
What was your MCAT?
Yeah.
Your science GPA.
Yeah, and I'm sure your hospital system, for all of their patient or physician bio pages, they typically list education, like medical school, residency, fellowship, and then they also have board scores, MCAT scores, GPA on there too, right? So
they actually have a sampling of the evaluations from clerkship too.
they got it all.
Representative comments. They have excerpts from the dean's letter.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. So Paul, you're on this mission to change things, which is an uphill battle, and I commend you on that. Where do you think is the quickest, easiest, low-hanging fruit for you to make a difference in this crazy process?
I don't know if those things can, quickest, easiest, low-hanging fruit. Man, it's like, to me, it truly is kindness and compassion
yeah
in the day to day.
Yeah.
Going back to that student that I was talking about, the small things like looking up and paying attention, encouraging. It's such low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
It really is to look at someone and say, "Hey, Ryan, really great job today.
Yeah.
Paul, really appreciate your thought today. That was, I think that really helped your patient out."
Cost you
with
nothing.
Everyone we work with.
Yeah.
Cost nothing. It's one sentence. And you can even vary in terms of sincerity.
Yeah.
But just saying it, I think it's so easy to call out what things that you see are good. And, you know, I've listened to leadership podcasts. I've listened to, you know, just how to interact and call out things that are positive publicly and have private conversations about areas that need constructive criticism or yeah. reinforcement.
Yeah.
Negative reinforcement. Like, call things out publicly. I think that's really easy. I think to me, the way that I work with students and residents in clinic is I always ask, or anytime I'm working with someone for a day, I ask what their goals are up front. Hey, what are your goals for today? What do you want to work on? And I visit that at the end of the day. That's actually how I do clinic visits. Clinic visits, I introduce myself to the family and I say, "Hey, what are your goals for this visit? What do you hope to get out of it?"
Yep.
I think that's a really nice way to, it's a really easy way to say, "Hey, I value you." So within education, I value you as a learner and I would love to hear what you want to get out of it. And then maybe I can say, "Hey, it's going to be a really busy day. I honestly don't think that I can have you do more than shadow. But what I hope to do is address your goal by doing this." So if I have a pre-med student with me, I'd say, "Hey, what do you hope to know about pediatric GI?" Honestly, I want to know what the field is. I've never heard of it. Great. Well, I think we're going to see what we call bread and butter cases today, like GERD or gastroesophageal reflux. We might see some constipation, maybe see some malnutrition or failure to thrive in babies. My hope is to show you that you see kind of the breadth of the field and how we kind of have longitudinal relationships with patients. I'd love for you to tell me your thoughts afterwards. That little tiny conversation at the beginning of the day before you get into the busyness. Set expectations, elicit goals. I think that's part of the education framework, but you can do that really easy. It doesn't have to be a structured, let's sit down and talk about your goals and
yeah.
feedback. And it doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
I think those two things. And then I think the third thing is checking in to see how people are doing. I had a part of the thing that really, really made me struggle in my first year of fellowship is we had our first son who was born when I was a first year fellow, and I won't get into the craziness of that, but let's just say medical education rears its ugly head a little bit when you can't put your personal life you can't prioritize your personal life sometimes, or you're sacrificing some things. Mm. And I kind of vowed there, I don't want to be a perpetuator of that. So when people are burning out, residents are burning out left and right, physicians, like people are leaving, like nurses are leaving the bedside, physicians are leaving their practice, checking in and actually asking, like, and meaning it. "Hey, how are you doing? How are you holding up with me?" Checking in with interns. "Hey, intern year is really hard. How are you holding up? Are you taking care of yourself?" And actually being curious about it. Medical students. "Hey, second year's hard. You're gearing up for the boards. Step one. Are you doing okay? You feel like you're getting time to yourself, or you have a schedule to recuperate after step one?" I think those are the three things you can do.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, Paul, Again, a lot of what we talked about is the dark side of medicine, the negative stuff, the things that have been an issue for a long time. And the student listening to this typically is listening to stories of success and encouragement. What do you say to them as they're like, oh crap, like I'm going to second guess this career, which is fine. We can do that. What do you say to them to continue to motivate them on their journey to becoming a physician?
I'd say, don't listen to anything I just said. I think it's really easy to focus on the negative sometimes because I was just talking about this with a colleague today. You can have tremendous positive affirmation, and it just takes one negative experience to just drown out all the positive.
Yep.
And that doesn't make it overwhelmingly negative. The negative is louder. The negative interactions or experiences can just be louder, even if they're much more rare. So one of the things that I would encourage you to do is bank positive experiences and bank the positive memories. And objects, really, patient letters, writing letters. You're working as an MA or you're working doing clinical experience, and someone gives you positive encouragement.
Yeah.
Someone says you're a scribe, and someone says, "Hey, I really appreciate like you were like on top of it today." Bank those things. Those things really will actually like you look back and like, wow. I'm focusing on that one negative experience, but in the past week, I've already had like 5 to 6 things that I felt really proud of or really happy with. So make a positive bank. That's a really practical thing. For me, maybe this, I didn't realize how overwhelmingly negative I have been if I have, but, encouragement from my personal perspective, I wake up every day excited to get to work. I'm so excited for the ideas I have within education, within clinical stuff, just research. I love it so much enough though that my wife is a PA, so she's never met someone in medicine who loves what they do so much. Like I feel like I found a field that I'm perfectly suited for and is perfectly suited for my like skills and interests. So like it's just like this match made, and overwhelmingly you can have bad days, good days, but like my basal or my baseline rate of happiness is sky high, and the peaks are not that are amazingly high, and the valleys are not that low. So find that field, I think, that does that. Not everyone's going to find that, and I acknowledge that I'm very unique in that, how much I love my field. I would feel like some of my colleagues in PGI are like, dude, really? You like it that much? But I've been lucky. I've been really blessed to find a field that I think I love, and then I get to do it. I think if you find that, fantastic. And crystallize your why, because if your why will sustain you. Your why will sustain you no matter what other people say and the extrinsic factors that come.
All right, there you go. Again, Dr. Paul Tran, pediatric GI doctor, who is doing his best to change medicine from the inside, to make it more encouraging and less kind of negative, and again, what we call eating our young. So hopefully his perspective is infectious and catches on, and more people understand that you don't have to be a tyrant to be a good attending or a good resident. I literally was just having this conversation with a student who is starting medical school soon. And one of the things that it sounds like they're concerned about is this understanding that, hey, like, are residents mean? Are attendings mean? And I said, yeah, just like anywhere in life, you're going to find people who have been through this process and people were mean to them. And so they continue that cycle. And I compared it. I don't know if it's the best comparison, but I compared it to domestic abuse, right? And the saying, hurt people, I think people who go through medical training, whether it's medical school, residency, fellowship, et cetera, and have these mentor figures attendings, residents, whoever, treat them poorly, a lot of it is just learned behavior. And they go, they treated me poorly. I guess that's part of the process. So I'm going to treat other people poorly, whether it's that conscious or not. I don't think it is, but I think it's just a perpetuation of this process. And again, the closest analogy, again, I don't know if it's the best analogy, so forgive me, but it's like domestic abuse, right? It hurt people. And that's the closest thing. Once I heard that saying from someone a while ago, it just makes complete sense. So hopefully what Dr. Paul Tran is out there doing is making a difference and making this process better for everyone. Hopefully this was helpful. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.